This special episode, A Conversation with Pastor Carlo Christopher, will be presented in two parts. Each part will be approximately 45 minutes long. Welcome to Community Lutheran Church's podcast, Bridges of Belief, being God's presence in a hurting world by accepting all people as we are created. Together we'll create a stronger community and a church renewed. I'm your host, Lee Trueheart. For this Bridges of Belief podcast, I can edit that part out. For this Bridges of Belief podcast, we're talking with Pastor Carlo Christopher, who is our visiting pastor, with a very diverse background. She is a diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility belonging trainer specializing in the LGBTQIA2S+, cultural competency and racial justice, trauma-informed care and mindfulness, nonviolent communication, and peace building. She is also a writer, performance poet, and former poet laureate of York, Pennsylvania, a deep believer in the healing power of storytelling and creative expression, founded and served as co-director of Poem Sugar Press Community Arts, Inc., which published more than 50 books by marginalized poets and authors over 5 years, hosted Culture in Maine on WRC-TV for 7 years, which has profiled 1,000 plus artists and community activists. That's really an amazing background. Thank you, Pastor Carla, for being with us. Let's start at the beginning. What stirred you, your call to ministry, and how did your identity play into that?
The first thought I had about becoming a pastor was actually given to me by people I was encountering working as a community organizer. I have always had a heart for God's people, rooted in faith, but about being with folks out in the streets, in their places of challenge. That was the ministry that I remember reading about in the Bible. Jesus went to the weddings, stayed at friends' houses, said, let's go into this little alcove or forest or garden and pray together. It was about just being with people and going to them, calling them by name, accompanying them in the most difficult parts and places of their lives, and also challenging them to do something new, to be brave and fight for what was just and equitable, even if that went against the status quo. And that's why even when I had my challenges with the church, I always loved me some Jesus. And I came from this background that was very intersectional. I was brought up very religious, but I was actually born conservative Jewish. And
wow.
It turns out in the 70s, being born to a conservative Jewish woman who decided to have a child with a African-American Catholic jazz musician, we weren't really accepted in either community of my parents at all. And so we were very much kind of on our own, finding our way in the world. And it was a group of little Episcopalian church ladies who took my mom in and helped watch me so that she could work, prayed for her, taught her how to cook, taught her how to dress me. Together, they figured out the adventure that is a biracial girl's hair.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, my earliest memories of the church are getting pigtails braided while watching the Rockford Files and Murder, She Wrote with Miss Lillian from the local Episcopal church. But that kind of love, acceptance, and practical showing up in the areas of need, that defined what doing the work of the church was for me. Okay. And so that was how I began doing community education and social work. And then running up against systemic barrier after systemic barrier that even made social work not nearly as helpful and transformational as I wanted it to be, I began getting involved in community organizing. And a lot of the tenets of community organizing were that you have to create space that the whole family can be a part of. Right. You have to create space that folks with challenges and mental health issues, mobility issues, financial issues, everyone needs to be able to come to the table and they need to be able to come together. And even in the world of community organizing, politics, legislation, that was hard to make the case. But some of our most frequent partners were congregations. Safe places, neutral places to come together, volunteers, open minds and hearts, and the good ones, but a place where there would be both a nursery and a handicap ramp, places that you could really be a part of at unconventional hours, weekends, weekdays, evenings. And as I'm working increasingly with congregations, doing diversity, equity, and inclusion training with them, coaching them on community engagement, and partnering them with nonprofits to do more of the work that the congregations were wanting to do, I had several pastors say, "Have you ever considered entering the ministry?" I said, "Oh, no, not me, not me at all." Well, why don't you try taking some of these classes, consider lay leadership, lay ministry, just a deeper involvement in the church. And I began taking classes and workshops, and the professors, many of whom were retired seminary professors, they said, "You ask too many questions. You need to go to seminary." And it turned out they were right. I went to seminary just to visit, and it felt like all the things that I had not understood, that I had questions about. There's two creation stories, and they're not exactly the same. Why are there two creation stories? Well, I know that I'm part of the LGBTQIA plus community, and I know that I'm created this way, and I'm pretty sure God loves me. I can feel that. I can see God working in my life, but there's some verses in here I have questions about. And I got to find theological answers that said things like, actually, the word homosexual wasn't even in the Bible until 1946. It's a translation error. Oh, what? And all of a sudden, the reservations that had kept me from thinking the church had a place for me, that I could be a leader in the church, once I started doing that deep learning, those reservations fell away. And I fell head over heels in love with theology and with the church and with creating worship. The poet in me loves writing prayers and liturgy. The speaker and organizer in me loves public witness. It has become the coming together of all those different, diverse parts of me.
Wow, that's neat. I like that. Such a, I want to know more. Sounds like a kid. Why? And the mother's just like, stop.
Holy curiosity can be the start of a whole new
All right,
life.
yeah. Were there moments when you felt the church didn't have space for you? You alluded to that and how you did find or create that space, but is there anything in the deeper realm that you wanted to say on that?
I left the church even after having found a lot of home there, because when I did come out, I was part of a more conservative youth program, like an ecumenical interfaith college movement, a lot of the type of movements that bring in young people, vulnerable people, lonely people. And when I said, "I'm pretty sure I'm gay," I was actually sent to conversion therapy camp. And without going into unnecessary detail, it was enough that I left the church for 10 years. I couldn't step foot into a church building without heart palpitations and very close to a full panic attack. And it took a lot of intentional work and kindness and patience from open and affirming congregations that, when I was willing to dip my toe in, invited me to do things that were comfortable and life-giving for me. "Hey, you don't have to join a committee or become a member today, but would you be interested in reading one of your poems as part of worship?
Oh, that's
Would you be interested in helping us do a meditative longest night ceremony on the winter solstice?" That's a creative, very non-structured, non-officially liturgical, just gathering to really celebrate entering into the season and giving us a calm spot to breathe before going into the hectic
Yeah.
charge that is Christmas. And those on-ramps, those gateways that allowed me to come as I was, not only were what made coming back into the church possible for me, but what deeply informed my ministry now as a pastor, that on-ramps for people from different places, different spaces, different
Yes.
backgrounds in life, there must be a way for people to engage that is healthy, that is
Right.
life-giving, that is grace-filled, and allows them to grow and to have choice and autonomy in deciding what living a transformational Christian life looks like for them. And we have to be flexible enough to recognize that the way one person's faith shows up may
That's not.
not be the same as
No.
another person's faith shows up, and that's okay.
Yes. Awesome. That's yeah, the background is an interesting thing of why people do and don't do things, but it's always it comes back to the church and a lot of times on why they do and don't do certain things. And it's a shame. And I'm glad of that I'm in a place now as well that I'm in a with a church that helps people get through that. Many of us talk about inclusion, but you live out liberation theology. What does that theology mean to you on the ground level of ministry?
So I love the term liberation theology. It just sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Like, this is about freeing us, and it's not just freeing us from our sin and our inherent evil. It's freeing us to live authentically as
Right.
our best selves, living lives of joy and community and relationship that we are created for. We have built-in needs. We thrive among people. There's good science for that.
Right.
That when we are surrounded by supportive, loving community, it's better for mental health, physical health, better with aging, better with recovery journeys for those living with addiction. The biggest major factor we can support for people's health, healing, and growth is supportive, loving, nurturing community. And so to me, liberation theology is when we can bring a large body of people of faith together to have a whole system-wide idea of what does it mean to free people
Right.
from that which has been keeping them out of community, which has been
Right.
preventing them from having the space where they could come together and receive those healing, transformational benefits of faith that allow them to grow and blossom into their own fulfillment, into who God created them to be. Liberation theology at its heart is the good news for the marginalized person, the individual who has not been free to be themselves with safety in community. And so when we have that liberation for people to be themselves, have full access, full opportunity, full ability to participate, and that includes ability to lead, to teach, to actively engage, to create, once we have that understanding that this is what the scripture calls us to, right? Because it's not just
Right.
liberation practice.
Right.
It is theology. It is the understanding that this is who God is, this is what God calls
Sure.
us to, and that our behaviors, our practices are reflections of a gospel truth that calls all of us to be full, valued, and valid members of the body of Christ. And if we're preaching messages, if we're using prayers, if we're teaching classes that do not uplift full access, opportunity, leadership, and belonging to those who have previously felt excluded,
Right.
then that's not liberation theology. And that's not the kind of faith and community that we see Jesus and the apostles building in the early church.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Are there particular scriptures or biblical figures that guide or inspire you in your walk?
I will forever return to the Ethiopian eunuch, which I love not only because it is a gender minority and a racial minority. This is also an enslaved person who was able to achieve very high status working as a high executive in Queen Candace's court. And also, this is somebody who is curious, is a learner, who's investigating scriptures that were not normally associated with belonging to enslaved Ethiopian eunuchs who would not have even been allowed into the inner sanctum of the temple at that time. But what I also love, what I especially love about that story, is that it is about the disciple following the leadership of the marginalized person. The
Okay.
marginalized person doesn't go to the disciples and ask. God says, oh no, I'm going to bring this disciple to this marginalized person because they matter and they are the center of this story. And then the marginalized person challenges the disciple and says, you know what? There's a river right there. Let's get baptized right now. Stop the parade. Stop the caravan. And the disciple performs the baptism, and then the disciple is no longer necessary and just vanishes back from whence he came. And the oldest continually existing church in the world is the Ethiopian Coptic Church. The oldest Christian church we have is not European,
Right.
is not the Roman Church. It's actually Black, Ethiopian, African Christians. That is our source. And legend and tradition has it that that church was founded by this eunuch. And that's part of why that story has endured and remained relevant over
Right.
time.
That's incredible to know. And I think it's the history that people don't know. And what would they be surprised at? There was a comedian who said, when they find out what the center of the universe is, people are going to be surprised it's not them. And I think that kind of goes with that a little bit.
Exactly.
What is something you would like more churches to understand about the lived reality of LGBTQ and Black Christians?
I think it does tie into that scripture in that a lot of times I feel that marginalized people in the church are often viewed more as service projects or mission fields than they are as resources, leaders, and incredible teachers. There is a resilience, there is a creativity, there is an ability to build intentional community, a strength and bravery that can go against the overwhelming push of the status quo culture or the dominant culture that is present in Black and Brown communities and LGBTQ communities. And as we see congregations entering into this new era of, oh, wow, everybody doesn't just by default join a church. How do we reach people? How do we build community when people are not coming out of obligation? How do we creatively think about stewardship and finance when we don't have a ton of people with extra money that are simply pouring into donating or leaving in their will the money to sustain our institution? Well, guess who already knows how to do that? The Black and Brown churches that have been worshiping in secret since enslavement, that have been holding fashion nights and cookouts to raise money because they didn't have endowments or even the ability to own land during segregation. And let's talk about how LGBTQ communities founded whole denominations to create spaces that offered worship and inclusion and celebration for those that were not thinking that there was a place for them. And there's so much that we can learn. LGBTQ and Black and Brown people are not those that we can feel good about saying, well, we'll let you come. We'll let you sit in the back. We'll let you be present. No. Marginalized people are the future of the church. Historically underrepresented groups in our mainline denominations are the reason why they have even a chance of continuing to survive in a way that is both reverent and relevant in 2025 and beyond.
Wow, yeah. I don't feel so irrelevant that, so you've likely served in or visited a range of congregations. What does a truly affirming church look like beyond the rainbow flag?
Some of the things that have been most frequently uplifted, not by, just by myself, but by countless people that I've surveyed, taught with, worked with, things that show an intentionality of welcome throughout the experience of the church. So, are we using gender-inclusive language? Do we have images of different family formations, different ethnicities, different ages? And physical abilities. Because if people are doing something simple like having a space for pronouns on name tags, they're not only likely to be more LGBTQ culturally competent, but probably intentional about inclusion and welcome in other ways as well. So there becomes a level of trust, and a maybe I'm willing to invite my friend or bring other people here. I think continuing education opportunities and engagement opportunities, specialized programming. We're going to keep doing what we've always done. We're just going to allow LGBTQ people to participate is not the same thing as we actually have authors and books and resources available in our library that are from the LGBTQ community. In fact, we use them in our congregational book studies. We make sure we're inclusive in the scripture translations that we use and in the verses that we choose to uplift. We make sure that we are offering learning opportunities that when we partner with community organizations, we're choosing ones that are in alignment with the mission of inclusion. There have been some very significant snafus, even this summer, where, festivals and concerts and tours that were supposed to be celebrating a certain population segment, but then, took a bunch of sponsorship money from people who lobby directly
Against
against
them.
their safety and inclusion and legal rights. We notice that kind of thing.
Yes.
So I think the importance of taking a step back and doing what is referred to in the DEI field as a soft equity audit. It doesn't necessarily have to be working with a trained professional and coming up with a whole expensive and extensive plan, but just imagine walking through your building, going through participating in your programs, looking at your website, reading your newsletter, and going through your constitution. A lot of congregations that are like, we're very welcoming, we're very inclusive, but they still have things in their constitution about who's allowed to get married there, who's allowed to be called as a rostered leader or a staff person. They have trainings or lack of trainings that they do not require or provide around cultural competency. So, going through that administrative practice, as well as what happens in worship, faith formation, youth group, and retreat, prayer, resource materials, all of those really matter.
Yeah, they do. I won't name any of the organizations, but okay.
We know who they are.
How do you help churches move from simply welcoming to actively centering marginalized voices?
I think it's very important to remember that when you center a valued voice, you are asking what that individual needs, and you are showing them the same respect that you would show any other professional who you are seeking consulting from. So I often say, if you would not treat a tradesperson in a particular way, please don't treat your marginalized people like that. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, you will ask, and many congregations, countless congregations have said, well, can you find us a Native American or a Black or an LGBTQ person to come in and speak? Now, we're only going to give them 5 minutes,
Right.
and we'd like them to travel an undisclosed amount without actually offering payment or offering mileage or
Right.
transportation support or assistance. We are not offering some kind of care. There's someone with them to direct them, introduce them around, help them navigate the building. So there ends up being a lot of labor and expense
Yes.
placed on the marginalized person. Whereas if we know that our plumbing isn't where we want it to be, we're going to contact that plumber. We're going to ask them what their fee is, and we're going to pay them promptly. We are going to make sure that someone's there to meet them, show them what to do, where to go,
Sure.
let them in, answer any questions. We'll even leave them a good Yelp review if we feel like we know how to do that. So it's really important to bring in and
Yeah.
uplift and center actual first-person experience, marginalized voices, not just here's folks that are not from that community, but they're telling about their experience with that community when they were a missionary or when they had something happen with their brother or their
Right.
child or their friend, or they did lots of research and wrote a book about this group of people. There's a place and a space for that as well, but it should be a supplement, a
Right, right.
follow-up, or a partnership with the actual leadership of marginalized people with first-person experience. And those people need to be honorably and respectfully treated, fairly compensated, and not just a one and done, bring one person in
Personal.
once either, because asking us to speak for an entire group of people is what we call tokenizing,
Right.
and that really simplifies us as individuals. As an LGBTQ person, as an adrenally intersex person, as a femme identified queer person, I have very different opinions
Yeah.
from lots of other femmes and queer people and lesbians. And there's no way that I can speak for every rainbow spectrum human
Sure. Right.
alive.
Absolutely.
So bring in my voice, but bring in at least a few others that represent different ages or areas in the neighborhood or the
Sure.
community, and do that regularly as a check-in, a reinforcement of the continued work. It's a way of sowing back into the community, and it is a way of helping build authentic relationships that promote empathy while building understanding that any part of our identity is part of our identity,
Absolutely.
not its entirety.
Absolutely. That very well said. Thank you. What are the signs that a church is growing, not just in numbers, but in compassion and courage?
So the ally trinity that I love to teach in a lot of my workshops is awareness, education, and action. A congregation needs to be engaged in some way in all three of those to be able to say they're doing the work of
Sure.
seeking to become better allies. So awareness is about how do we know what's going on in this community? Are we participating in community groups? Do we just say we love Black people, or do we have members in the local NAACP?
Yeah.
Do we have people that are part of supporting different festivals and groups, agencies, and schools? Do we know what the Black newspapers are in town or the organizations that support Black people that we can be keeping up with what's actually relevant to a particular community?
Right.
At Raising awareness around that is raising our own awareness and then also making sure there's a way that's being shared in the community. Education becomes not only how do we learn more about how these situations came to be, and then also how are we empowering and equipping people to do something about them? How are we learning
Right.
how systems work? And then action is what are we doing to make a difference? You cannot claim to love someone if you know they're being hurt and harmed and you don't feel called to do anything about it.
Oh, right.
And so to say, well, we absolutely send thoughts and prayers. If you knew that someone in your family that you're close to, a best friend, was struggling, besides the very beautiful and valuable thoughts and prayers, What else might you feel called to do? Would you be engaging in harm mitigation? Would you be engaging in advocacy? Would you be just engaging in checking in and saying, what do you need? How can I be there for you in this time? A simpler way of putting that is, who are the people that you are touching? Especially because church membership, regular attendance used to be coming every Sunday. Well, now what's considered regular attendance is coming maybe twice a month. So we're not necessarily going to see people every single Sunday. So that can't be the only way we're active in people's lives. How are we connecting with people in the community? Through acts of service, through uplifting events, through attending other people's events as supporters? Are we creating social spaces? Are we using our building to share with other people who need a safe gathering space or a resourced gathering space? It's not how many people showed up on Sunday, it's how many lives did we touch? How many people did we
Absolutely.
impact throughout the week? That has become the new metric of how are we growing in mission, ministry, and connection.
That's great. I know that I've mentioned this before too, is when you talked about the awareness, communication, and education. I use an acronym ACE, which is acknowledgement, communication, or in education, because you can't, like you said, you have to have all three. You can't do one or the other without the other. And when people, I don't think people realize that they do that every single day with certain things, but then when it comes to what they don't know or what they don't find is correct or they think is sinful or anything like that, one of them will drop off. And most of the time it's education.
Ooh, I'm using that. That's excellent.
Ministry isn't easy for anyone, especially from the margins. What keeps you grounded when things get hard?
Peer support is vital. I definitely believe every pastor needs a therapist, just like they say every therapist needs a therapist, because we do spend a lot of time absorbing trauma. And spending time with folks in the most challenging spaces of their lives.
Absolutely.
So, having places to process that so that we don't hold it, we don't end up with compassion fatigue, burnout, just going numb. It's important to remain soft and able to feel and be affected so that we can have the empathy required to do this work faithfully. But that means we also need to be finding ways to release some of what we hold, and then also refilling ourselves with joy and positivity. So, having that therapist, having that spiritual director who encourages us to stay accountable to our spiritual practices and not get caught up in overworking and doing the things, mindfulness and meditation have become incredibly important to me. Regular retreat, time in nature, and thinking about what brings you joy? What brings you energy? What can you be doing and lose track of time? So for me, it's the arts. So part of my pastoral sustainability package is plays and concert tickets, going to campouts at least a couple of times a year, and just being in the woods, spending time by the water. All of these things that take me out of some of the challenges of the world and show me the ways that God is still working. And also, it's very important to have a peer support group that are not necessarily folks you are taking care of in that space or ministering to in that space, but who also can minister to you or just listen to you and can laugh with you and can travel and journey with you. And, having a place to be able to really relax and let your guard down, healthy home life and doing the work to keep that home life healthy, having positive spaces and non-toxic spaces where when you are with family or with coworkers, addressing conflicts and identifying stressors and doing what needs to be done, which sometimes means prioritizing personal over professional. But if you cannot decompress when you are home.
Sure.
You cannot come in to your place of work or call and not bring that with you. So
Absolutely.
caring for family, caring for friendships, caring for self and home, that is essential for my being able to care for other people.
That it's in, I look at what you said about the in a sense the decompressing part of it. There's so many, and I, because of it being a veteran, I have seen people that have not decompressed before they came back over from the Gulf War. In, you know, wars prior, they had the time of traveling that would decompress them with other people. Now they just fly back. And it's the same idea. If you just go from this to this to this, I'm sure that it's just, it just starts piling on top of you before you can be too much buried.
That is a perfect example because I do think that working with veterans and having several in my family who have and who do continue to live with effects of PTSD
Sure.
and mental health challenges after being overseas, being deployed, that gives us a very clear, tangible example of what a difference it makes, not just to do the work, but to be part of a system that builds in appropriate preparation,
Right.
education, nurturing, preparing you before you go into a difficult space. And then also, how do we hold space for the transition afterwards?
Correct.
That de-escalation, decompression, processing, talking it out, being with people who have experienced the same thing. There are some things that my grandfather, my brothers, they would never tell me who
Sure.
wasn't there.
Sure.
And so it was deeply meaningful and essential for them to have their siblings in arms that they could share those things with and not feel bad about dumping something that might break the
Right.
heart of someone who had no idea.
Absolutely.
And quite frankly, I do the same. There are things I have dealt with in
Sure.
hospitals, and I was a chaplain in a prison. I was a chaplain in the ER and the acute care unit. There are stories that I do not bring home to my family.
Sure. No, that'd be too much.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And so having other chaplains, having other hospital staff to be able to process that with,
Right.
was part of how I cared for both myself and cared for my family.
Right.
And I think that's something the church can do.
Sure.
But when some of those challenges happen in church spaces, it is also important for leaders to curate their spaces where
Absolutely.
they can take that and not bring it to the church or put it upon the church.
Right.
So
To
I'm a
take
big
that step
fan.
back.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of sabbaticals
Oh, yeah,
and
definitely.
rests and Sabbath days. It is too easy to let that go, but long term, it is more harmful to the church than helpful.
No, I agree with that. I know a lot of people at work that never took a day of leave, and like, that's not good. You know, mental days. I used to call out sick just for a mental day. And that's the reset you have to do more than anything. So definitely not just here, but up there too.
No, Jesus modeled that.
Oh, yeah,
This is
definitely.
literally biblical
Yeah.
that Jesus was like, okay, I am about to go into some really difficult, challenging situations, and I want to be able to be calm, be centered, be faithful. And so let me spend some time with my close friends. Let me spend some time alone in prayer and
Absolutely.
meditation. Let me spend some time in nature, in the garden. Let me rest. Let me talk to God. And then I will go into this thing. We have a very detailed, frequently reiterated biblical
Absolutely.
model of self-care that is key to following, especially when it's marginalized people who may be experiencing more stress navigating faith spaces
Right.
and regular dominant culture logistic life spaces.
Right, absolutely. Have you ever experienced transformation in yourself or others that gave you new energy to keep going?
That is a huge part of why I teach and why education is something that is so important and special to me, because seeing other people have their aha moments and their transformation moments gives me so much hope and excitement and joy. It's also why I make sure to not only teach, but also spend time with other marginalized folks who we can be together in LGBTQ centered spaces. And as much as I love teaching, being a BIPOC person or an LGBTQ person in mostly straight or cisgender spaces and mostly white spaces, and seeing those beautiful aha moments, I also regularly give myself the gift of being with folks who get it, who I don't need to translate myself or speak in ways that are intentionally accessible, especially for those of us who live life on the margins and who have to do a lot of extra work navigating in daily life. Having those spaces where you don't have to do that labor, I think, is really important. So at least a couple times a year, I'll go to some place that is a town or a festival or a retreat that's mostly LGBTQ people. I'll spend time with friends and family where I'm mostly around BIPOC people, not because I don't love and value my friends who are part of dominant or majority cultures, but because sometimes I just want to not be learning. I want to not be translating. I want to not be growing and acting in my intellectual superpowers, but just be. And that allows me to actually rest, replenish, and restore in a different way.
That's awesome. How do you practice spiritual care for yourself in the midst of doing so much for others?
It really does require an intentionality that causes people to chuckle at me because I have two paper planners, and that's actually become part of my spiritual practice. And I worked with my spiritual director on figuring it out. I light a candle and I have my little home altar set up, and I put some soothing music on, little flute playing, little madrigal chants happening. I put on some comfortable clothes. It's a real nurturing time for me. And then I pull out my planner and I map out my week. And I look at not just what I'm doing, but what's the travel time involved? What's the prep time involved? A lot of this, it's tools that I learned in task management and executive function management as someone who also lives with ADHD, that my brain often goes so quickly that I am tempted to say yes to more than what is my healthy capacity, and that I do not always break things down into all their components. I think, of course, I can write that two-page paper, but before I commit to that two-page article, I need to actually think about how do I write best? I actually write best when I am in a quieter space and I have some time to actually sit down and just freestyle into the computer. And then I really love to go back and edit, move the pieces around. So, if I'm going to be working from my tablet or my cell phone because I'm traveling that week, it is going to be 10 times harder for me to write than if I'm going to be at home. And so it's become important to me to look at not just what is the task, but what is the environment in which I am doing the task? What's happening before that, after that? Is there going to be something in this week that's going to take a lot of energy? Maybe I need to have a lighter, lower key end of the week. And so, taking this really intentional meditative time to map out from a larger picture what my week looks like and being willing to say, no, I can't do that right now, but I'd love to refer you to someone who can, or I'd love to partner with you. But can we look at that next week or next month and not feel a sense of urgent guilt? Part of that comes down to faith and trust. I have not always been financially sustainable. I spent a lot of time being a broke social worker and caring for multiple family members who had a lot of health challenges. And, the fear that, well, if I say no, they'll never call again. Or if I don't take this job or do this task or this conference, then I won't ever have another opportunity. And then I look back and say, girl, for more than 40 years, God has cared for you. Do you believe in this stuff you preach or don't you? And so, where a lot of my transformation has been is in challenging myself to trust God to care for me. Not just to trust God to care for others, that actually comes easy, but trusting that God also loves and will care for me.
My dad, when he commissioned me, he told me a few things. One of them was on opportunities, and he said, "You don't know if they're for you if you don't look at them, but you can say yes or no, but you have to look at them first fully and then be able to answer the question." And I grew and understood that, but at first I was like, okay. But he was always the go see do, but looked at those opportunities to be able to do that. So I did learn a lot that way. And it sounds like that's what you're saying as well.
That's good wisdom.